Hello.
Hi. Hi.
I'd like to really thank you. That was wonderful. A lot to observe. Wonderful. I just wanted to ask, because from, you know, there's a lot of information, but what I understood, it's like you need to be in a certain state. Please forgive me for my paraphrasing, yeah? I don't know the right words.
Don't worry.
You need to be in a certain state to then go and do the... to then be successful.
Okay.
To then be able to meditate. You have to come already from clearing the hindrances or... And I've just been in a retreat, Vipassana retreat, like full on, Wat Chong Tong in
Nia. Yeah.
And you do, and from, you know, you practice that the meditation.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a way.
Yeah.
To,
absolutely.
So suddenly,
yes.
Like when I hear you say, no, you have to, then I'm like, oh
yeah.
My God, but.
No, it's not like that. Remember that this sequence is both sequential, but it also loops back around, and every factor of the Eightfold Path strengthens the other factors. So it doesn't really matter where you begin, but you do need every aspect of that path. So of course you can start with right mindfulness, which is probably where you started on that retreat. But at the same time, you'll find over time that if your virtue, you know, for example, if you have a habit of lying or drinking alcohol or something like this, over time that will weaken the mindfulness. So you need to be cultivating that quality as well. Yeah? And also paying attention, like hearing the teachings of the Buddha, having a sense of the bigger context of the path and how to practice. This is going to guide that mindfulness in the right direction. So we can really start anywhere on that path. It doesn't really matter, but it's when all those factors come together that things get much easier. And it's important to recognize that along the path, you don't need to worry about what's going to come next. Along the path, we already start to receive the benefits. The Buddha said that the Dhamma is good in the beginning, the middle, and the end. It starts bringing benefits to us from wherever we start to practice. But we do have to practice in this holistic and integrated way. So I hope that helps explain it a little bit.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gentleman here, near the front.
Thank you so much for your teaching. So the question is, when you try to calm your mind, means if you have good will power, you can simply understand and you can free from your own suffering. But the thing is, the closest to you, like family, parents, it's really hard to let go of their suffering because you're also understanding
yeah.
that they're going through some health problem, financial problem, even parents. How we deal with that?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Yeah, if our family are suffering, the people close to us are suffering, how do we manage? I think the first important thing is to still give yourself time to practice and to actually... learn to relate to your own feelings of concern and maybe worry for them in a compassionate way. So to give yourself some compassion, first of all, and to recognize that this is coming from a wish to care. But in order to care in an appropriate and effective way, we need to have some amount of stability and calm. So to give yourself those opportunities to process your own emotions, I would say, first of all, and get clear on sort of the situation at hand, so that you can then approach it in a skillful way. And of course, when we learn to develop compassion to our own emotions, it's much easier to hold space for other people as well. And if your loved ones are suffering, you might be able to give them just a loving presence without running into fix. I think sometimes, you know, we have this feeling that we want to fix it for others, and we can't really do that. But I know for myself that... the best friends in my life are people who can just listen. people who can just hold the space without judgment, without trying to kind of make it better for me, and just give me the time to process. And I'm able to do that for others if I've learned how to stay embodied in myself and present to my own suffering. So that there's a sort of emotional boundary, but it's a soft one. It's a soft one, but I know where my world starts and also ends, and where this person's world starts and ends. So I don't have to run in to fix it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Just checking if there's anyone online who'd like to raise a question. Please let us know by raising your hands using the Zoom icon, please.
I'm just wondering if anyone in the Zoom might also like to put it in the chat box. I don't know if that's functioning. Sometimes
it is.
If people are shy.
So there's one from Georgia Dixon. We were trying to read this out. With regards to blameless bliss, how can we work with regrets from the past coming up as an obstacle now?
Yeah, super question. I'm sure everybody has that. So one way to see it, first of all, I think, is to make it a universal thing, because everybody has done things in the past that they're not proud of, that they wish they'd done better, that, you know, they keep on beating themselves up for, and, you know, you're only increasing suffering for yourself. You did the best you could do, given the conditions, given your knowledge and understanding at the time. And it wasn't only you involved in the situation, there were so many other conditions. The other person, you know, your resources at that time, your state of tiredness or resourcefulness. So many things were at play. And so forgiveness is so important. Self-forgiveness and compassion. The past is the past, and it's okay to let it go. You know, in the monastic Sangha, we have every 2 weeks, if we have a big enough community of four or more monastics fully ordained, then we have what's called the Patimokkha. And at that time, we bring forward anything that we have done that we feel was not quite, you know, in line with the Buddha's guidelines for us. And we have this sense of accountability. So we tell the community, okay, I made a mistake in this way or in that way. And there is no punishment there at all. It's just a matter of acknowledging the mistake. The community give a sense of forgiveness. They also encourage us to try not to do it again. And then we let it go. Yeah? Acknowledge, forgive, and let go. So you deserve forgiveness, so be compassionate to yourself. And, you know, you can also make a determination to try to learn to do it differently in future. And also tell yourself that if you fail again, fail, so-called, you'll forgive yourself again. So sometimes I think we need to behave towards ourselves, treat ourselves the way we treat a child. You know, one of the things about Ajahn Brahm that I really love, and I realized after a while, is that he actually talks to people with a lot of respect. He respects everybody's capacity for awakening because he knows it's a conditioned process. It's nothing to do with the self, with an ability or capacity or any of that self stuff. But at the same time, he talks in such a loving and kind of relatable way that he's speaking to you as though you're a child. And in a sense, we all are, right? We're still growing up, so we're still learning. And just as children need a lot of encouragement, a lot of forgiveness, a lot of care, so do we. So please forgive yourself and let it go. If you can't do that straight away, one of the practices I like to do is, okay, I intend to forgive. And you can do it almost like a metta practice. So you sit at the end of a meditation, maybe, when you're feeling mindful, and you just bring up the idea of forgiveness, and you say to yourself, I intend to forgive. May I forgive myself for whatever it is? Or I offer myself the intention to forgive and move on. I allow myself permission to make mistakes and to grow. Yeah? So find your own words, but there's no point holding on to the past.
We've got a lot of appreciative messages for you.
That's very nice.
Parindi says, thank you, Venerable Chanda. It's wonderful to be in your presence, even if online.
And yours.
lady here in the second or third row. This one here.
Sorry, ignorant, but I was just...
No. All questions are good.
From a practical perspective,
yeah.
From a practical perspective, you're saying to integrate both your pasana and samatha. Like, if you were going to sit for an hour, I've only ever done pasana, sitting like, I was in Burma too, and it was quite hardcore on pasana out there. I was just wondering, how would you integrate? I mean, I did samatha back in England, but I don't know how to merge the two.
Yes.
Luckily.
Right. No, it's great because this is the question I was trying to address all along. So thank you for bringing it out so clearly. The point is that whatever you start from, whichever approach you take, you will be practicing both. You will be practicing both. Another simile that Ajahn Chah gave was it's like two sides of a hand. If you're calming the mind, you are going to see things more clearly. Remember the simile of the water. As the water gets calmer, stiller, you're able to look into it and see more deeply. As you see more deeply, you understand the nature of the mind much better. You understand how to calm it further. Right? So sometimes, of course, we can emphasize one above the other. That's possible. And I think to some extent that depends partly on our own inclination. Like, some people find it much easier and much more attractive to practice methods that predominantly aim to calm the mind. Other people find it much more interesting and engaging to practice with methods that examine and investigate the mind. So it can definitely differ from person to person, from personality to personality. I was much more inclined in the beginning, or seemed to do much better with the insight practices, which were aimed at insight, right, predominantly. But as I say, calm was developing alongside it. And at some point I realized that my wisdom faculty was probably a little bit stronger than the calm. Now I'm not so sure I can compare it, because I do really believe they were developing together. But I did realize that I hadn't experienced the depth of stillness that was available through the path. So I chose to practice more samatha meditation, but in doing that I found that a lot of insight was arising again in the way to approach it. And I found that just by simply trying to hold my mind to the breath, I'd realized this a long time ago, it was so uncomfortable, it simply didn't work. And there wasn't much wisdom involved. But when I understood that, by putting the causes in place for meditation to arise, the mind would find stillness by itself, then I started to really enjoy the process of calming the mind. Does this make sense? So in other words, I started to realize it's a conditioned sequence, and maybe it doesn't make sense. But basically, if I was struggling with any particular method, I would kind of backtrack and see, okay, what causes do I need to put in place, rather than just trying harder or just picking up a different method. Yeah? So it was less and less about the method and more about my approach. And one of the main principles in my practice today is to really focus on my relationship to whatever's arising in the mind. So whether the breath is there or not, whether thoughts are there or not, whether I'm doing insight practices or not, is less important than whether I'm having compassion, a sense of letting go, a sense of loving kindness. So I put my attention there. Does that make sense? And then that is a wisdom faculty, and it will lead to calm. So it's both. It's both. Yeah. But feel free to experiment your practice. It's not like there's a right or a wrong way, and everybody's very different. The practice changes throughout our practice life. So there might be years that you're really keen on a particular method, and then at some point you realize there are some other qualities and strengths you want to develop, and another approach may be better. But every approach should be doing both. If it's not leading to more insight and more calm, then something might be amiss in the approach. Yeah?
Matthew, go ahead.
Thank you. So the question is, if someone has caused you harm,
yeah,
and you're not able to forgive them because you don't have the capacity,
yeah,
won't this harm your practice?
It will if you don't forgive yourself for not being able to forgive them. So you can start with yourself. Forgive yourself. Sometimes it's too much to try and forgive someone who's really harmed us. Sometimes our mind's not ready to do that. So we need to start where we are, you know. Sometimes we can't send loving kindness to the enemy. It's okay. It's the hardest person to work with. We start where it's easiest. And over time, we develop inner strength. So please don't ever think you have to stretch yourself or you have to make yourself be somewhere you're not. It's about embracing your own mind and body, emotional world now, and learning to be compassionate to that. Yeah. And then you'll be progressing.
Thank you. Another question.
Yeah.
So, human mind is always driven by rewards, recognition, or at least they see that something is working, driven by results.
Uh-huh.
Is in terms of meditation, how do you know that something is giving you result, or you are on the path that you
great question
something or...
For me, the way you know that you're developing in the meditation is that your actions of body and speech are improving. You're doing less harm. So it's almost like the Samatha and Vipassana. We talk about all these highfalutin ideas, right? We talk about deep meditation. We talk about, like, you know, the highest wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, compassion and the rest. How are you living your life? If you think you're wise, if you think you're smart, but you're still kind of harming others... You're still acting like a jerk, you know. I'm sure you're not. But, you know, there's not that much wisdom there. It's not integrated. So it really should start to change the way we are in our life gradually. You know, say anger still arises, sure. You know, we're not anagamis. We're not free from anger and craving at this stage. But it should be arising less and also lasting less time. So the anger may start to dissipate more quickly. That's a sign that you're doing well. Maybe before you got angry 8 times out of 10, now you get angry 7 times out of 10. Fantastic. One time you're creating no harm. So small steps, but over a longer period, there should be a general trajectory whereby your actions of body and speech are becoming increasingly supportive, harmless, encouraging, loving, compassionate. And then you know your practice is on the right track. That's the best way. Yeah. You can actually ask the people around you as well, if you really want to. But don't criticize, you know, give yourself time. Yeah. If I'd have asked my parents in the beginning, I'm sure they'd have said, gosh, you just think she's better than us, you know, always talking about meditation, like, as if we don't do anything good. I don't do that anymore. So now I think they've realized, yeah, I committed to this, something must be working for me. And they've realized I've matured. So,
okay.
I hope.
We've got Charanjit.
That's one question.
Yeah, can we just go online and we'll come back to you? Just give me a second. Charanjit, I wonder if you could ask your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Vikram, for a very full explanation, but I'm still struggling to understand. You mentioned doubt, and I just want to know, do you ever have doubt, and how do you deal with it?
How do
you ever have doubt?
Do I ever have doubt, personally?
Yeah.
Doubt? Proper doubt is fully overcome through the experience of the Dhamma. So the fetter of doubt, of kind of knowing and sensing and having some experience of the Four Noble Truths, is still there until stream winning. So I'm not allowed to say where I am, but basically it's natural to have doubt. So by coming to listen to a Dhamma talk, you're not going to understand everything about Samatha Vipassana. You're not going to overcome the hindrances completely. But the idea is that by exposing ourselves to the teachings of the Buddha, we become clearer and clearer about the path. We can't actually understand the path before we try and walk on it. So again, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to fall off. You're going to get confused. It's part of the process, and that's okay. So sometimes we overcome doubt by actually giving something a go, taking a step. You take a step, does it work, does it not? Okay, adjust it slightly this way, slightly that way. Okay, I think I'm on the path. Great, I'm on the path for a bit. Oh, I'm going left. go right, okay. Oh, I'm going too far right. Come back to the left. Apparently Ajahn Chah used to be criticised sometimes. They used to say, oh, you know, he keeps giving different instructions. He told this one to go left. He told this one to go right. Which one? Well, if you're going too far to the right, I'm telling you to go to the left. If you're going too far to the left, I'm telling you to go to the right. So experiment for yourself. But the best way to overcome doubt at this stage is to keep on learning the teachings of the Buddha, associate with spiritual friends, and also not just listening to the Dhamma, but asking questions, which you're doing, and also discussing the Dhamma to clarify doubts. So we all have doubts to some degree, but little by little they do dissipate, and the doubts may be kind of subtler. I don't really have a doubt about the Buddha's teaching or the Dhamma or, yeah, but I'm sure that there's a deeper level of faith that's yet to come.
There was another question here. Yeah.
Is there a difference between the mind's desire to commit violence and to be capable of committing violence? And as I ask this, I see a spear in one of the photos. Is there any wisdom in lethal tools tied to the first question?
So is there any difference between like wishing to create harm and actually creating it? Is that what you were asking?
Being capable
of it. The thing is, unfortunately, we're all capable of it, right? We're all capable of it, and we have to be so careful, because depending on what we expose ourselves to, we're more likely to commit harm. So we should never think that other people who are violent or who use lethal weapons, even in very obviously intentional ways, are different from us. They've just been exposed to the wrong kinds of people, the wrong kind of input, you know. Maybe they got caught up with, I don't know, like a kind of radical group of religious fundamentalists. Any one of us is susceptible to that. There's really no difference. And that's why we have to be very, very careful about the input that we take in. Yeah, everything in our mind is conditioned, entirely conditioned. Of course, some people may be more inclined that way, but, you know, things could change for us given the circumstances. So obviously there's a difference between intending harm and actually doing it, and hopefully if we have enough mindfulness and we see those kind of unwholesome thoughts coming up, we can, you know, maybe laugh at them actually. We can't always get rid of them, but we can say, okay, this is a thought, like, I'm not going to listen to this. In the Buddha's teachings of the enlightened monks and nuns in his day, they had this phrase, I see you, Mara, or I know you, Mara. It means this is an unwholesome thought or a not very wholesome intention, and it's kind of this naughty Mara. It's like the personification of, I don't know, sort of the devil or sort of all things bad. It's like, oh, that thing, that kind of influence is now in my mind. I see it. And as soon as you see it, it tends to disappear. You know, it's like there's a distance there, there's some awareness there, and you have a chance to pause and decide what you want to do. Yeah. Does that help? Sort of the question.
Yes. We're going to have two more
there's
questions.
There's one down here.
And then we're probably going to wrap up.
This gentleman's put his hand up a while.
So.
Hi. She can see me. So yeah, my question is around practicing through your work. So I get a lot out of helping those who are suffering. My work's conducive to that.
Fantastic.
And I'm able to work in that way, and I touch into that feeling that you describe, and it's very fulfilling.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, and it's pure, and it's all those things that you want it to be. And then I have to monetize it.
You had to monetize it, yeah.
That's where it becomes.
Yeah.
It becomes heavy,
right?
And it almost this becomes a rub, which takes away from the purity of what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I'm then having to take money from these people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's almost balancing living in this world, this modern world, with the practice. I don't know if you have any insight into that.
Yeah, it is the kind of world we live in. I guess one thing is to recognize that you have basic human needs. You too count. You can help alleviate others' suffering, but if you don't have anywhere to live, if you don't have enough to eat, then how can you continue? So you do need to earn a livelihood, and it's wonderful that you do that through wholesome means. sometimes we start to think we've got to charge the market rate, even though we do know that it's a bit expensive, and we do kind of start to see greed slipping in. So sometimes maybe it's possible to give some reduction to some people. I don't know what kind of work you do. I mean, it might not be that kind of job. But we can still do things for others outside of that as well, you know, where we do cater to people maybe from marginalized communities or people of lower incomes who don't have the means to actually, you know, pay to support your livelihood in the same way. But I think to recognize that that is the reality. I mean, it's the same for monks and nuns. You know, we also need to receive dana, you know, in terms of financial resources, material resources, food. If we didn't have food, if we didn't have someone paying for our train ticket, then I couldn't come here today. So this has to happen. And it's a give and a take. Maybe they're happy to be paying for something. You know, maybe they're happy to be, you know, putting their money where, you know, into somebody who's doing good. So I think to try to reconnect with the sense of joy that your livelihood brings you is important. And the Buddha had a method that he very much encouraged called Silanusati or Chaganusati. And it is a reflection or a recollection. It's a kind of mindfulness that brings up in your own mind the good that you've done. So at the end of the day, when you've been working in your livelihood that you enjoy, instead of focusing on the fact that, okay, people had to pay, I had to monetize it, etc., wow, you know, I can do something like this that's so coming from such a good place, and I can earn my livelihood. I'm not doing that through unskillful means. And think about all the ways that you've been helping people. Really go through it. Remember someone's face, the sense of relief, a sense of like rekindling hope in a person who maybe had lost hope and then met someone kind. Think of the actual concrete ways you've been helping and allow happiness to arise. This is so beautiful because that is the kind of wholesome joy that you can put straight onto your meditation. So if you begin your meditation that way, then you'll find your mind does start to calm and feel some uplift, and you'll find the meditation much easier.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sorry, can you get the microphone?
We have been always talking about calm and peace and all these things. But then how did the group of 19 wants to develop a physical endurance to walk from Texas to Washington?
Yeah, that was amazing. So we're talking about the group of monks, I think about 30 monks?
19.
I think 19 monks
walked from
Texas
to Washington.
Yeah, they walked
too. And they have done the same, similar walk on the path of actually Buddha in India.
Yeah.
From all the places that, from Varanasi to Buddhagaya and all those places, proving that actually Buddha really walked, not actually was doing anything else, but actually taking time to walk. So they did this in 180 days, 2,300 miles, and that is physical endurance. So with mindfulness, can we do that?
Well, I mean, yeah, so we're talking about the group of monks who walked from Texas to Washington, D.C. It was called A Walk for Peace, and I do believe they trained very carefully for that. So mindfulness was definitely involved. They would have had to be mindful of a lot of pain. They'd have had to be mindful in the sense of discerning of the dangers on the way. They would have had to be mindful in the sense of maintaining a kind of very wholesome intention, right? Understanding the purpose of what they were doing. That's a kind of mindfulness, sati sampajanya. And having a lot of compassion as well, so wisdom as well. And as you say, you know, people have been doing this in the monastic life for thousands of years. There was also a group of up to 500 nuns. They were not nuns yet, but women from the Sakyam clan who walked from, I think, Kapilavatthu all the way to Vaishali to ask the Buddha for their ordination in the Buddha's day. And they walked barefoot. These were women who'd been brought up in a palace, very delicate, Their feet were bleeding, they must have been exhausted, and they didn't know if they'd be, you know, accepted or not, and they did this out of compassion, out of anukampa for the world. So yeah, certainly the monks who did this would have had a certain degree of mindfulness, of commitment, a great degree of compassion, and I think they brought a lot of peace to people throughout the world. Yeah, so thanks for reminding us of that. Did I actually answer the question? I'm not sure exactly. Did I answer the question?
Yes,
sir. Yeah? Or was there something more to that?
But my question was, can we develop mindfulness into that extent?
Can we develop mindfulness to that extent? I mean, that's an interesting question. Obviously, it depends on physical ability to some degree, right? But I don't see why not. I don't see why not. I mean, sometimes it's not that we have to first have the mindfulness, then only we do it. Sometimes you're training on the job. You know, you start something with a very strong intention, with a bit of training, but then you kind of understand what it is you're doing when you're actually doing it. That's what I found out in starting a monastery. I had no idea. I mean, you don't go to, you know, you don't do a degree in how to be an abbot or how to be a bhikkhuni or any of that. You just take the plunge through faith, through, you know, deep intention to try and do good, and then learning on the way, taking it step by step. So I do believe that people can do this if they wish. And we don't have to do 2,300 miles, right? We can do a day walk. I understand there have been lots of walks for peace since then, smaller walks, week-long walks, whatever it is you can do. You know, anything that can bring the message of peace to more and more people, I think, is incredibly compassionate. So we don't always have to, like, go for the 2,300 miles, but certainly where there's a good intention, there's a way. Yeah.
I think we've just about wrapped
it up. Okay, so who's going to do a peace walk now?
Okay. So, if I could just make a few comments. Thank you so much, Ajahn Chandra, for a very illuminating talk. Principally about the Noble Eightfold Path, which I think is always the best topic for a talk, because
that was the talk that obviously the Buddha,
the first sermon,
really was about the Noble Eightfold Path and the Middle Path to liberation. So I think that really was a very powerful talk, if I may say, and I think a very engaging one. And we look forward to you coming to the Vihara on another occasion. So Ajahn Chandra has very kindly also mentioned that Ajahn Brahmani may well be coming to London Buddhist Vihara when he's next on a tour of the UK, and at the end of it he'll be coming to London Buddhist Vihara sometime in June. And more of that will be circulated to everyone prior to that. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank a lot of people, actually, who come together to put this event on. We had a talk with Ajahn Chandra a few weeks ago, if I remember rightly, trying to get this event put together. And it took a lot of planning and arrangements because Ajahn Chandra lives near Oxford. And I think she's also suffering from a little bit of a sore throat. So we're even more grateful that she came today and gave such a very good talk. As I said, there are a lot of people who come together to put these events on. I'm extremely grateful for all of those people. I know that today, from judging by the comments in the chat, that our sound on Zoom hasn't been as best as it should have been to everyone. And we're probably going to have to look at and review that amongst ourselves.
we have got a new internet service at the Vihara, which hopefully is a much stronger service than the one we've had in the past, and that should help us. But I notice still that there are some challenges that we need to overcome. Nevertheless, I would like to stress that we have a very strong team and a very talented group of supporters and volunteers who support all the events that we put together. And I'd like to thank especially people like Graham, Steve, Marlinda, Rajita, who have helped enormously today and continue to support the British Mahabodhi Society in London Buddhist Vihara. We have some refreshments organised for the people of the Vihara, and please wait for that. And I'm sure that Ajahn Chanda will stay behind to answer any questions that you have personally and to meet with you all as well.